Okay. The course we are beginning today will be called The Fundamentals of Buddhism. So as it is called Fundamentals of Buddhism, this course is on just the fundamentals, and we will not go too deep into the teachings. As the fundamentals, first, we need to know the three gems in Buddhism, or three refuges in Buddhism. The subjects we are going to teach in this course may be already known to many of you, but I hope that there will be some topics or some subjects which you need to understand more clearly, or to polish your understanding of these subjects. So there will be things which are already known to you, and also maybe some things which are new to you. So if there are things that you already know, please be patient, because hearing again what you already know can fortify your understanding and make your understanding firmer and clearer. Since we are studying the fundamentals of Buddhism, the first thing we should know is about the person with whom what we call Buddhism started. And that person was, as you all know, the Buddha. And also we need to know something about, at least at this class, something about what he taught, or some of his teachings. And also we need to know who preserved the teachings of the Buddha, and who brought down the teachings of the Buddha from generation to generation until the present time. And these three are called the three gems in Buddhism: the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So before learning the teachings of the Buddha, we first need to know the Buddha. Now, the Buddha was an historical person. He really lived and taught over 2,500 years ago in what are now known as Nepal and India. So at the time of the Buddha, there was no India, there was no Nepal, but they have other names. So the Buddha was a real person who lived and taught over 2,500 years ago in Nepal and India. He was born and brought up as a prince. And he renounced the world at the age of 29. He renounced the world because he wanted to find a way to end all suffering. He saw beings suffering, and so he wanted to save. That means he wanted to help beings save themselves from suffering. So in order to find the way to end all suffering, he had to give up his kinship, his parents, his wife, his child, his kingdom. So he renounced the world and went into a forest and took the garb of or the dress of a monk and became a recluse. And for 6 years he practiced austerities. He practiced many forms of severe practices with a view to gaining the way to end all sufferings. And at the end of 6 years, he attained what he was after. That is, he found the way to end all suffering. He practiced that the way himself, and he got the best results of that practice. That is, he became the Buddha, the fully enlightened one. And he taught all beings for 45 years. He taught every day to all who came to him for guidance. And at the age of 80, or after teaching for 45 years, he passed away. So at the age of 29, he renounced the world, and he spent 6 years in the forest. So he became the Buddha at the age of 35, and he taught for 45 years, so he passed away at the age of 80. You may want to know in what year he was born and in what year his passing away took place and so on. We are fortunate that we have these dates. According to the reckoning traditionally handed down in Theravada Buddhist countries, Buddha passed away in 544 BC on the full moon day of May. Now you might want to know how we get that year. Now, in 1956, the whole world celebrated the 2500th year of the Buddha's passing away. So 1956 was 2500 year after the death of the Buddha. So if we subtract 1956 from 2500, we get 544 BC. So the Buddha passed away in 554 BC, and his passing away took place on the full moon day of the month of May. Now he taught for 45 years. So we add 45 to 544, and we get 589 as the year of his enlightenment. So he became the Buddha on the full moon day of May again in the year 589 BC. And when did his renunciation take place? In what year did he renounce the world? How many years did he spend in the forest? 6 years. So you add 6 years to 589, and so you get 595 BC. And that took place on the full moon day of July. You remember? When we get the date of the year of his renunciation as 595 BC, we only need to add 29 to 595, and so we get 624 BC as the year of his birth. So Buddha was born as Prince Siddhartha on the full moon day of May again in the year 624 BC, or 624 years before Jesus Christ came to the world. We will learn more about the Buddha in our next class. Now, some characteristics of the Buddha. Now, we want to know what the Buddha was. Was he a god? Or was he God? Or was he a prophet? Or was he a savior? Or was he just a human being? So we want to know that. Now, Buddha was not God with a capital G. Sometimes when friends meet each other, they would ask, who is your God, or something like that. And Buddhists sometimes say, Buddha was our God. But that is not true. Buddha was not a God with a capital G. That means Buddha was not the creator of the universe and so on, as in Christianity. And Buddha was not a god with a small g. Buddha was not a celestial being. Buddha was not the deva. He was a human being. And he was not a prophet. He was not a messenger of any god. He was just a human being. But he was an extraordinary human being, because by his own human efforts, he attained the highest spiritual attainment a being is capable of. And Buddha was only a teacher. Buddha was not a savior. Sometimes when we meet friends of other religion, they ask, can Buddha save? And our answer is no. It may be discouraging to know that Buddha cannot save us. Buddha cannot save us because it is impossible to save. Saving really means helping a person to save himself in the Buddhist sense. So sometimes we use the word save, and Buddha appeared in the world to save beings. And here saving means not turning the beings into enlightened persons, but teaching them and guiding them on the path to to enlightenment or helping them to help themselves. Now, when a person becomes enlightened, that means that person eradicates mental defilements, impurities in his mind, in his or her mind. Now, can anybody enter into your mind and take those impurities out of your mind? Can anybody do that? Not even the Buddha can do that. So that is why it is impossible, say, to save beings just by grace. What Buddha did was helping beings save themselves by teaching them. So Buddha was not a savior, he was only a teacher. So since he was only a teacher, he can he can only teach us, and the rest is up to us. We must make effort ourselves. And Buddha once said expressly that I am, you yourselves must make the effort. Buddhas are only teachers. So Buddhas are not saviors, but they are teachers. They are infallible teachers. They can show us the way, the right way, the correct way, the sure way to emancipation or to the eradication of all mental defilements. And in order to become the Buddha, he had to make a superhuman effort. Even in his last life, even in the life when he became the Buddha, he had to practice severe meditation for 6 long years. But before that, for countless, not even countless years, for countless eons, countless lives, he had to fulfill what are called paramitas, perfections, or necessary qualifications to become the Buddha. So he became the Buddha not for nothing. He had to make effort himself. He had to sacrifice many, many things in order to become the Buddha. Now, what are the qualities of the Buddha? Whenever we say the word Buddha, we always say the fully enlightened one. So Buddha was the fully enlightened one. He became enlightened by his own effort, without the help of any human being or celestial being. And he possessed the total purity of mind. That is one great quality that Buddha possessed. Total purity of mind. Now our minds are always with impurities such as attachment, greed, hate, delusion, pride, and so on. Now it is said that the mind of the Buddha was totally free from all these mental impurities. Since his mind was totally pure, he was not capable of anger, not capable of attachment, not capable of pride, and so on. So even though there was provocation, he would never get angry. So this total purity of mind is one outstanding quality Buddha possessed. When we hear the words total purity of mind, we may think that this quality is not so great. But if we compare our minds to the mind of the Buddha, which is totally pure, we understand that it is a great quality, an admirable quality. Now, for us, we get attached to things which are desirable. Say we see something beautiful and we are attached to that thing, or we are attached to persons. And when there is some provocation, we just get angry. We do not put off getting angry. We get angry at the moment we are provoked. Now, in such circumstances, it would be very difficult, almost impossible, not to have attachment, not to get angry. But Buddha, since he possessed the total purity of mind, or since his mind was totally pure, he would never get attached to anything at all, or he would never get angry with anything or any person at all. Now, his cousin Devadatta attempted his life how many times? 3 times, right? Devadatta attempted to kill the Buddha, but it is said that Buddha was not angry with him. Actually, Buddha had compassion for Devadatta. And it is said that Buddha had the same attitude towards his son as towards Devadatta and other persons who tried to kill him. So, the total purity of mind is a great quality, and it is very, very difficult to possess such a quality. And Buddha did possess that quality as a result of his efforts, superhuman efforts. The other quality Buddha possessed was omniscience, that is, knowing all or knowing everything. Now, in order to get this quality also, Buddha had to spend countless eons and countless lives. So, actually, it is no wonder that Buddha possessed this great quality of knowing everything. When we see how long he fulfilled his perfections to achieve this knowledge. Now, in order to become a doctor, how many years does a person have to spend?
8 years.
How many years?
8 years.
So, but before 8 years, he had to attend the school for 12 years maybe, right? So about 20 years, a person has to learn for about 20 years to become a doctor. And when he becomes a doctor, it's no wonder, because he had put much of his effort, 20 years effort in this branch of knowledge. But Buddha not attended the school, but Buddha spent billions and billions of lifetimes to acquire necessary perfections. And so it is no wonder that Buddha possessed omniscience, knowing awe, or all-knowing wisdom. And this all-knowing wisdom was not for the Buddha to show off or to boast of. It is a tool for him, or he used as a tool in teaching other beings. With the help of omniscience, he knew exactly what to teach, how to teach, and when to teach. That is why his teaching was always successful. Now, we should know what to teach, right? But actually, teachers nowadays don't know exactly what to teach, because they don't know what qualifications their listeners have. Now, I cannot decide what to teach actually to you, because I don't know how much of Buddhism you already know, or whether you are complete beginners, or whether you are advanced students of Buddhism. So I don't know, and so I don't exactly know what to teach, but I thought that since it is the course on fundamentals of Buddhism, I must begin with the Buddha and so on and so on. But Buddha would know exactly what to teach to anybody, any person, or to any audience. And also Buddha knew how to teach. Buddha taught beings in different ways. He used the method which will be most beneficial to the persons he preached to, or to an individual that he was teaching. So he knew exactly how to teach. And also, he knew exactly when to teach. Sometimes a person is not ready to accept his teachings, not ready to understand his teachings and to practice what he taught. But Buddha knew when to teach such a person, whether that person is mature enough to understand him and to follow his teachings. So with these three qualities, knowing what to teach, how to teach, and when to teach, it was no wonder that Buddha was always successful with his teachings. If you have read the discourses, you will find that, say, at the end of this discourse, so-and-so became enlightened, or many beings, including celestial beings, became enlightened, or see the light of truth, and so on. So, Buddha possessed omniscience, not to show himself off, but to help beings to get free from suffering. There are many more qualities of the Buddha. It is said that even if a Buddha would talk about the qualities of another Buddha for the whole of his life, doing nothing else, the qualities of the other Buddha would not be exhausted. So there is no end of the qualities of a Buddha. So now we will go to the Dhamma. Now there are three gems in Buddhism, and the first is the Buddha, and the second, the Dhamma. Now what is the Dhamma? We usually translate it as the teachings, right? The teachings of the Buddha. Now, the Dhamma actually means what Buddha realized at the moment of his enlightenment and what he taught to all beings. That is the Dhamma. So Dhamma does not mean only those we find in the books, but also those many people experience during their meditation. Or in other words, the Dhamma means the path, the fruition, Nibbana, and his teachings. There are four paths, four fruitions, and Nibbana. So when we say Dhamma, we mean all these 10 things. When we say Dhamma with regard to the three gems. By the way, the word Dhamma has many meanings. We cannot translate the word Dhamma by one English word. So the meaning varies with the context. So we must understand the meaning of the word Dhamma according to the context, according to where it is used. So when we say the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, we mean by Dhamma the path, fruition, Nibbana, and also his teachings. Or in other words, Dhamma means what he realized, what the Buddha realized at the moment of enlightenment, and also what his disciples realized at the moment of enlightenment, and what the Buddha taught to the world. Now, how big is the body of his teachings? It is said that Buddha talked very fast. During the time when an ordinary person says one word, Buddha could say 128 words. Unbelievable. But there are people nowadays who talk very, very fast, and still we understand him. So, with that speech, Buddha taught for 45 years every day, and so his teachings would be very, very great. Even the gist of his teachings comprises 40 volumes now, about, say, 300 to 400 pages each. So there are so many teachings in the of the Buddha that sometimes we might say, oh, there are too many things to know and we cannot hope to understand his teachings. But on one occasion, Buddha summarized his teachings into just one verse. And I think we should all learn that verse. Many of you already know what that verse is. And that epitomizes the teachings, all the teachings of the Buddha. And that verse is, it's very simple. Do not do any evil. Cultivate good and purify your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. So only three things, very simple to understand, but very, very difficult to put into practice. Do not do any evil, do not do what is bad. We sometimes, or we often do what is bad. Cultivate good, do what is good. Sometimes we don't want to cultivate good, we don't want to do good. So Buddha said, do what is good. practice charity, practice keep moral precepts, practice meditation. So that is what is meant by cultivate good. And then purify your mind. Our minds are always contaminated with impurities. And so Buddha urged his followers to purify their minds. So when mind is purified, that person experiences a true happiness. So if we can follow just these three pieces of advice, we would be the most happiest people in the world. Do not do any evil, do what is good, and purify our minds. So this is the teaching of the Buddhas. Buddha did not just say purify your minds. He taught us what to do to achieve the purification of mind. He gave us the three steps to be practiced one after another along the path to spiritual attainment. And the first of these steps is, in Pali it is called sila, the moral purity. The moral purity is the basis of all spiritual practices. And moral purity means purity of bodily and verbal actions. We do not do anything wrong with our bodies, and we do not do anything wrong with our speech. That is, we abstain from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, and we abstain from telling lies and backbiting and so on. The second stage Buddha taught is samadhi, purity of mind. Purity of mind through concentration. So concentration of mind is the second stage to practice. And in order to practice concentration, there are a number of subjects of meditation. And we will talk about these later in the course. And the third stage is called panya, wisdom. Actually, wisdom here means knowledge of the true nature of things. Knowledge of the true nature of mind and body, or mind and matter, and also the knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. Now this third step, wisdom, is actually the outcome of the second step, concentration, which is based on the first step, sila or moral purity. So if we want to reach the higher stage of spiritual attainment, we have to go through these steps one by one. So without achieving the first one, the moral purity, we cannot hope to reach the purity of mind. And without the purity of mind, which is concentration, we cannot hope to gain the knowledge of the true nature of things, and we cannot hope to penetrate into the Four Noble Truths. So Buddha gave us this, let us call a blueprint for the spiritual growth for his disciples. If anybody follows these three steps, he or she is sure to reach the final stage of spiritual attainment. Now we come to the third gem in Buddhism, the Sangha. Sangha means a group or a community of individuals. But here, the community of individuals who follow his teachings and who have become enlightened. So the enlightened disciples of the Buddha are called Sangha, the community of individuals. And also the community of monks, nuns and novices who follow his teachings, rules and discipline. So this community is also called Sangha. And the second Sangha, the community of monks, nuns and novices, may comprise of both enlightened and unenlightened individuals. But the first Sangha, the community of individuals who have become enlightened, comprises of enlightened persons only. So both of them are called, collectively called, Sangha. And Buddhists are encouraged to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. Now it is this, it is the Sangha, especially the second Sangha, that preserves the teachings of the Buddha and brings them down to the present generation. It is a community of monks and maybe the nuns also in the olden days that preserves the teachings of the Buddha and handed down the teachings from generation to generation until the present time. So we need to be grateful to the Sangha for taking, for bringing the teachings of the Buddha up to the present. If there were no Sangha, we would not be here today practicing meditation or talking about Buddha's teachings or learning about Buddha's teachings. So it is a Sangha that that perpetuates the teachings of the Buddha and hands down the teachings from generation to generation. And also the members of the Sangha are not the mediators between the Buddha and the people. Lay people can approach the Buddha direct. They don't have to go through monks. So monks are not mediators between Buddha and the people, Buddha and the other beings. They are just spiritual guides for the lay people. Now, monks, since they have renounced the world, they have more time to devote to the study and the practice of Buddha's teachings. So they are more favorable, they are in a more favorable condition than lay people to practice the Dhamma and to study and to preserve the Dhamma. So that is why we take refuge in the Sangha too. Out of gratitude, say we take refuge in the Sangha. It is a Sangha brought us the teachings of the Buddha. So, as I said, the Buddha's teachings, or the Buddhism, was handed down from generation to generation for more than 2,500 years. Along this 2,500-year journey, there appeared divisions of Buddhism. It is a sad thing to talk about divisions of Buddhism. I want there to be only one Buddhism, but I cannot help. So there are now in the world two major divisions of Buddhism. The first one is called Theravada Buddhism, and the second one, Mahayana Buddhism. Theravada Buddhism was for some time, or even now in some places, called Hinayana Buddhism. But that name was not accepted by Theravada Buddhists, because Hinayana really means an inferior vehicle. So I belong to Theravada Buddhism, so we call ourselves Theravada Buddhists. Theravada means the teaching of the elders or something like that. So Theravada Buddhism preserved the teachings of the Buddha in the original form. So it is understood that the original teachings of the Buddha were to be found in its entirety in Theravada Buddhism. In Mahayana Buddhism, it is, I think, different. There are additions to the teachings of the Buddha. Some new suttas were added, some new discourses were added, and so on. That is according to our interpretation. So there are two divisions of Buddhism nowadays. And the first one, Theravada Buddhism, flourishes in countries like Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia. These five countries are known as five Theravada Buddhist countries. But Theravada Buddhism is also found in Nepal and Vietnam. I was told that Vietnam was the only country where both Theravada Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism flourish. Mahayana Buddhism flourishes in Nepal. So we can find Mahayana Buddhism in Nepal, Bhutan, Tibet, Mongolia, China, Korea, Japan, and Vietnam. Theravada Buddhism was also called Southern Buddhism because it spreads towards the south, from the middle of India towards South India, and then to Sri Lanka, and then to the east, to Burma, Thailand, and so on. And Mahayana Buddhism is called Northern Buddhism because it spreads towards northern countries from India, like Tibet, Bhutan, Tibet, Mongolia, China, Korea. So there are two divisions of Buddhism nowadays, Theravada Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism. Since I am a Theravada Buddhist, I know about Theravada Buddhism only. And please do not ask me about Mahayana Buddhism. I am not qualified to talk about Mahayana Buddhism with authority. And I don't want to make mistakes, or I don't want to misrepresent Mahayana Buddhism or any other religion. So ask me about Theravada Buddhism and I will answer as best I can. Now this class, that is today's class, is meant to be an introduction to the fundamentals of Buddhism. And so the introduction to the three gems of Buddhism are dealt with. We will spend much more time with the second gem, the Dhamma, than the Buddha and the Sangha, because actually we are more interested in what the Buddha taught, the Buddha's teachings, than maybe in the person or life of the Buddha. I tell this not because I'm ungrateful to the Buddha, because we should be very much grateful to the Buddha for leaving this heritage behind. But we are selfish persons, so we always think of the benefits we will get from the understanding and the practice of the teachings. So the teachings are more important for us than the life of the Buddha or actually the Sangha. So we will spend more time in studying the important teachings of the Buddha. This class is just an introduction to the fundamentals of Buddhism. Okay.